Defenses, right? So we're going to start looking at defenses to the tort of negligence. And as we did with the battery intentional torts, we're not going to study every defense there is. We're going to study a couple of the main defenses you need to learn about. And just as you now know, because you've experienced big law students, right? You know that because it's a defense, it means that the defendant bears the burden of pleading and proving it, right? Anything that's a defense, an affirmative defense, we keep that label for something for which the defendant has the burden to plead and prove. The first defense we're going to look at is comparative fault, okay? And the one thing I want to clear up beforehand is just terminology. Because as you probably saw in the notes, there's every terminology in the world out there. Okay, so the first defense we're looking at, we're going to call comparative fault, right? We're going to look at comparative fault. And whose fault are we comparing in unison? Plaintiff and the defendant. So we're looking at the defense of comparative fault. In other words, whether plaintiff should recover nothing or should recover less because of their own fault. Okay? And that's what we're going to use the word comparative fault to mean. It is an argument that plaintiff's conduct constitutes a defense. Okay? What other scenario? And everybody see how in many states this is a question of how much the defendant has to pay, right? It's about how much liability the defendant has. The other doctrine, which we will actually do on Thursday, is a question of whether you have two negligent defendants. So if you have a negligent plaintiff versus a negligent defendant, we're going to call that discussion the defense of comparative fault. If we have two negligent defendants and we're trying to decide how much they should pay, what did we decide we're going to call that discussion? Apportionment. So we're going to call this discussion how much each defendant should have to pay and what doctrine we use to decide who pays how much, an apportionment discussion. Okay? Now see how that's similar, right? Because it's all about, hey, if these people are negligent, what share do they have to put in? Do they have to pay the whole thing? Do they have to pay nothing? For that reason, annoyingly, the third restatement calls both of these discussions what? Apportionment. And we're not going to use it in that sense, right? We're going to keep apportionment to simply mean the distribution between the defendants, but you will see increasingly, because of the third restatement, a discussion of how you divide it up between plaintiffs and multiple defendants called apportionment. So they will call both things different flavors of apportionment. And we're not going to do that, but I can't guarantee you I control the world. In fact, I can guarantee you I don't. Everybody see what labels we're applying? Good questions. You asked her a question? Nope. Okay, anyone got questions? Everybody good with the labels we're using? Okay. So we'll go with those labels. So we're looking at the defense of comparative fault, and then on Thursday, we're going to look at apportionment. It's not a defense, right? But we're going to sneak it in there because it looks so like comparative fault. So what we're doing on Thursday is apportionment, which is not a defense. It's a question of who pays what between defendants. Good? Okay, so for many of you, today is the day that you've been waiting for. In other words, all through the term you kept saying to me, but plaintiff, shouldn't take anything. Plaintiff was stupid. What about what plaintiff did? I kept telling you, don't worry, there's a defense coming, right? And now you should see fulfillment. Oh, yeah, it's true. So the first thing we have to distinguish in comparative fault is there are actually two systems. Two approaches. And there's the old approach, which we tend to call the contrib system. Okay, so in unison, what was the old approach, which is illustrated in page 419 to 420? If plaintiff was negligent, plaintiff took
nothing.
Bingo. So the old system is that any amount of negligence on the part of the plaintiff barred recovery, right? The contributors, and there are about five states or four states in the District of Columbia who still stick with this old system. Lovely little states, okay? So that you prove the least piece of fault on behalf of the plaintiff takes nothing. And these tend to be called contributory negligence systems, contrib systems, okay? And then the other flavor is the comparative states, which is the vast majority today. They imply a comparative system. Good? Comparative system. Okay. One interesting thing that I just want to lecture through, it's in the first few pages of the notes, is why it is you would say that a plaintiff who was a little bit at fault took nothing. Okay? So that's what the old system used to say. One theory, so if you look at the early pages, 420 to 421, one theory that people have today is that the contributory system just got cause and fact wrong, right? So they say, well, if the plaintiff caused it, they are the cause, so you can't meet cause and fact. And we know that is not true, right? Just because plaintiff is one of the causes, right? So if I negligently step out in front of Professor Wood's very fast car, he's driving negligently, I'm negligent, I'm a cause, he's a cause, but for works fine. Right, everybody see that? His negligence is a but-for cause for my injury, my negligence in stepping out is a but-for injury. So there's no cause in fact problem just because you have multiple actors. Right? So you should not simply conclude that because plaintiff is an actor, you have a cause and fact problem. The other possible explanation for why they came up with it is that they had some kind of proximate cause vision of it, right? So the question, you would see me stepping out as a superseding cause and say it cuts off liability to him, right? So some people theorize that what the courts were actually doing when they said contributory negligence, you can't take anything, is they had this superseding cause theory, that any time the plaintiff did anything negligent, they cut the causal chain. Okay? Now, are you ready? Did you not write this down because it's history? Okay, we're not going to run the plaintiff as a superseding cause. Did I just say that? Yes, I did. We are not running the plaintiff as a superseding cause, because that's not what most courts do today. So if you see the plaintiff doing something, oh look, the plaintiff stepped out in front of the car. Oh look, the plaintiff, I don't know, dive-bombed out of a plane and landed in the road in front of Rick's car. We are not treating the plaintiff as a superseding cause, right? We're going to reserve superseding cause language for when third parties do something wrong, right? Which were all the incidents we saw, right? Some idiot picks up the dynamite and takes it somewhere else, right? It's not the plaintiff. It has to be a third party to talk about superseding cause. And if the plaintiff has done something to contribute to the accident, we're going to treat it in comparative fault. Right? We're not going to say they presented a superseding cause problem. We're going to say the plaintiff's action should reduce or bar her recovery. See what I'm saying? Everybody happy with what I'm saying? Because you could put it in both places. And some courts, even today, would say, oh, plaintiff was a superseding cause, that's why she takes nothing. But most courts today say, okay, plaintiff was a cause, but we're just going to discount in the defense. Got it? Okay, the last one I just simply want to lecture through, and the only reason I'm lecturing you through is the Ohio Bar is obsessed by this stupid doctrine, the last clear chance doctrine. The last clear chance doctrine was one of the ways when you were in a contrib system, every now and then they got worried about the squash plaintiff, right? Because the plaintiff's going to take nothing. So within the contrib system, there were lots of mechanisms to try and help plaintiffs. Juries sometimes nullified and said, oh no, she wasn't really negligent. She took reasonable care when she stepped out, right? So jurors would sometimes nullify to help plaintiffs. But one doctrine the courts invented was the last clear chance doctrine. And this, so everybody see the fact pattern on this? The fact pattern that you see time and time again is The railroad is negligently speeding down the track. The plaintiff negligently gets his truck stuck. Okay? At that point, what would the railroad engineer decide? Break or not? Is there any problem with you not breaking? Are you going to pay? Under the current TRIP system? No, because plaintiff was negligent. You're like, oh, free kill! What's that awful game that boys play? No.
Grand Theft Auto.
Grand Theft Auto! See, it's Grand Theft Auto, and you are the engineer. You're like, wow, I can take that guy out because he was negligent, so I'm not paying. See it? That's the way contrib works. As long as the plaintiff was negligent, you had zero liability. It cut off. So even though you're negligently speeding, just keep on going because you have no liability. So they got a little concerned about this. So what does the last clear chance say? Yep.
If the defendant has the last opportunity to prevent an accident resulting from the careless act of both the defendant and the plaintiff, then the defendant cannot be protected by the contributory negligence.
Bingo. So if the defendant has the last clear chance to avoid injury and doesn't take it, then he can't escape on the theory of contributory negligence. Right? Because they didn't want those little railway engineers just running over people. So that's the last clear chance doctrine. If the defendant has the last clear chance to avoid it, then he can't escape liability by pointing to the plaintiff's fault. Okay. Other than that, we're done with contrib. Contrib's really simple, right? Plaintiff at fault takes nothing. The difficult issue, and it will reverberate next week, is what to replace it with and what are the ramifications of what you replace it with. So one option you could replace it with is divided damages. So this is the little boat case. So let's get the little boat case up here. So here's an option, United States versus, actually it was Reliable versus United States. And this illustrates divided damages, which is one possible approach. Now, only very few of you have highlights, right? Because I started a new shape. Anyone want a green highlight? It's the color of the day. Miss Evans would like a green highlight. Okay, what happens?
A tanker ran aground on a sandbar, and the Reliable sued the United States for failing to maintain a flashing light on the sandbar. The district court found the apportionment to be 25% would be paid by the Coast Guard, but then 75% of the fault would be on Reliable, so they would pay 75%.
So why did they think Reliable? So they find the U.S. negligent because it doesn't maintain the light. What is it that the captain did of the tanker which caused the trial court to think 75% went to the plaintiff?
That they were equipped with all sorts of charts and lookouts and radio telephones, but chose to still go around and pass another vessel and set off on a new path. And even though the seas were, I think there were high waves or something, he should have taken more caution instead of just setting out on a new path.
Right, he just requested his own guesswork. Yeah, that looks good. Right? Doesn't check the maps, doesn't check the radar. Hey, I think we should go over there, right? Okay, so the trial court says, look, that looks to me 75% of the fault is plaintiff's captain. Okay, if we did divided damages, which was the old Admiralty way of allocating fault, because now we've decided we're going to allocate fault between plaintiff and defendant, how would you do it?
Well, then it went to the circuit court, and they found that it would be 50-50 under the admiralty rule because each party would bear half the damages.
So how does divided damages work? Suppose you had three parties.
Equal.
Bingo. So they pay a third each. You have two parties here, so it's a half a half. Okay. What's the other option we have for dividing it?
Well, the Supreme Court then held here that admiralty should not be stuck in the old ways, and that they should go to contributory negligence cases And maritime collision or stranding liability should be allocated proportionally to fault and only equally if parties are equally at fault.
So you do it on their proportion of fault, right? Which in this case would be 25% to 75%. So if we go with divided damages rule, how much does plaintiff take?
Half.
If we go with comparative fault, how much does the plaintiff take?
75%.
25%, because we discount by their fault, right? So they're 75% responsible, so we discount by their fault, so they get 25%. Everybody understand the choice between a divided damages system and a comparative fault system? Both of them are saying that plaintiff can be negligent and still recover, but they do different things with it. Now, I'm going to argue that this one's better, divided damages, because it's old and it's British and we love it, and you can tell me I'm wrong and try and argue for comparative fault, which America overwhelmingly adopts, right? They don't just adopt it in admiralty cases. Most states adopt it for every single tort. So I'm ready. You ready? Mine is easy. You want to know how to do mine? Count the people. One, two, and then that's how much they pay. Three people, one, two, three, a third. Mine is superior because it's efficient and easy for the parties and the court to apply. Yours is awful. Because you're like, ooh, I think it's like 75% his fault. You have no clue how much it is. Like, what? How come it's not 70? You just made 75 up, didn't you? You're like, she's more. It's like those stupid talk shows, those sports talk shows. Oh, it's definitely 75%. You just made that up. My system, clear, predictable, easy to apply. Yours, fake, made up. Case closed. Now you get to argue back. Because you got the U.S. Supreme Court and most of America on your side. So you should be able to win. Yes.
It's not fair if one of the parties is less negligent than the other. If the court finds that one party, in this case, was 25% negligent, and they're more likely to litigate and recover more.
So you're admitting mine's more efficient and easier to apply, but yours is fair. Even though you're making it up, it's fair. Yeah.
Yours is actually less efficient because this case may not go to trial because they realize there's 75% in the hold for it, so they may not get the damage.
Oh no, mine's going to settle faster. I have a settlement advantage too. Okay, here's me advising my client. Client, there's two of us, we have to pay 50%. They're like, yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm like, sorry, there's two of us, 50%. Yours, here's you advising client.
Well, I think a jury might think that maybe we're 60. Your client goes, oh, no, I don't think we're really that bad. I'm like, well, I'm just guessing, but I would think a jury would say maybe we're 70. Mine's gonna settle because both sides absolutely know what the price is. We know what the price is. Your system, the settlements will go on forever because you can't really tell your client how much they're gonna have to pay. Once again, mine's just superior. Yes.
Your system argues that it allows both sides to be more careful, but I would say it doesn't, because if you know you're gonna be 50% at fault, regardless of what percentage of care you take, then as long as you're not more than 50% at fault, it doesn't really matter.
So you're saying that yours causes people to correct their behavior because they know the more negligent they are, the more they pay?
It can be 30% at fault and not pay for 50, while yours just says if you're found to be at fault, then you're going to pay 50 regardless.
Okay, so he says it'll incentivize people to be more egregiously wrong because they know they count at 50. Good argument. Other arguments? Yep.
England has since dropped that.
It's true.
So.
But yours is just so much harder than mine. Mine
came up with the same comparative fault.
Yes, but mine's so simple and superior, and yours is just painfully hard.
Yeah?
In cases where both parties can come to some sort of a remote agreement that they're both equally at fault, they'll still settle out of court. And in cases where they can't come to that decision on their own, justice is more important than efficiency.
So even though it takes a whole load of work and it's really hard to predict, you guys are with this comparative fault system? Because it's fairer? Is that where you are? Okay, then don't whine to me about how hard the material is for the next 2 days, right? Because don't tell me, it's not really clear. How do you prepare for percentages? I'm like, I told you that day one, didn't I? I said this would be really easy, but instead, no, you're like, oh, we want to be fair. We want to carefully assess who's at fault. Well, congratulations, that's what we're going to do. Right? But you will pay the same price these next couple of days as litigators do. And maybe you're right. Maybe justice is more important than efficiency. But don't want to meet. Wasn't that clever? See, I turned the tables on you, Yasmin. Okay. So, overwhelmingly, states go here. Right? They do not adopt divided damages. So we'll take divided damages off the board. And we'll simply try and work on what does comparative fault mean? How do you run it? Let's look at the Ohio case, Hunt versus Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction. Okay. So we'll do the really easy bit, which is what system of liability does Ohio have? Does it have a contrib system or a comparative system?
Comparative.
And where did it come? Did it come from a court decision or is it in a statute?
Yes.
Statute, right? So Ohio has a statute which moved Ohio from contrib to comparative. So many states made this move through statute, some made it through judicial decisions. Okay. We'll do the easy thing first. So, we're applying comparative. What percentage of fault does the court assign to the plaintiff and the defendant here? 40-60. Okay? So, the court assigns 40% to the plaintiff, 60% to the defendant. So, how would you work out how much plaintiff recovers? You can actually do the math here. Total damages, which is what? 18,000. Okay, and then what do you do?
Times 0.60.
Right, so you discount by the 40%. So they're going to recover 40% less because only 60% is attributable to the defendant. Everybody see how you do your math? It's much nicer if it's round numbers, but you should be able to work out exactly what plaintiff gave you, and if you can't, it's at the top of page 429, right? So she gets 10,800 because you discount for her own recovery. Okay, one interesting thing, why is the court doing this? Who usually sets these percentages and does the discounting?
Jury.
Why is the court doing it? The court did it in the last case, the court is doing it in this case.
Because an admiralty and government institutions, a judge
decides the... Bingo! The last case was a judge case, an admiralty case, remember? And there's no jury in admiralty cases. And this is actually a court of claims case. A case against the government goes to the court of the claims and there's no jury. So here we see judges doing it, but it's usually the jury that sets the percentages and does the discounting. Are we good? See, we only have one minor problem. How did you come up with the percentages?
Magic.
Matt, see? But no. You love this system. It's what's fair. Oh, well, how are you supposed to work it out? So what is it we're actually comparing? I mean, are we saying that 40%, like 40% of the fingers were caused by the plaintiff? No, obviously not, right? So we're not really saying plaintiff caused 40% of the harm. So what are we comparing?
Would it be the duty they have to each other?
The duty? Okay, so you want to look at duty on both sides? What else do you want to look at? Who said it?
Everything.
You have to do 2 negligence cases. Oh, but you like this system, remember? Oh, it's so fair. Oh, it's wonderful. It's awesome. Okay? You are comparing the negligence of the defendant to the negligence of the plaintiff. That's why it's called comparative fault, right? So to get at those percentages, you have to prove that the plaintiff was negligent, that's the defense, and then the prima facie case, which you'd actually run first, right, that the defendant's at fault. And when you've run this prima facie case, you've run this case of negligence, then you get to say, well, whose fault do I think is worse and by how much? Okay, let's do it. How do you think the injury, right, is going to be the same for both? Right? Because what we're saying is the plaintiff's injury was caused by the defendant's negligence and by her own negligence. So what's the injury here?
Seven fingers.
3 severed fingers. Okay. Let's do the prima facie case first. Was defendant negligent? And we know the answer is yes. Duty. What duty does the defendant is the defendant owe to the plaintiff? So could anyone find the duty? It's a very short case. Yep.
Reasonable care.
Reasonable care. Okay. That's what you're taking out of duty. Reasonable care to do what?
To is properly instruct, wasn't it?
Reasonable care to warn. Reasonable care. So you want a duty to reasonable care, to warn, to protect, to tell her how bad the snowblower was. Is that an easy or hard duty? That's a hard duty, right? We're not saying they ran over her with the snowblower, right? Or that they took her hand and shoved it in. We're saying they failed to warn or protect. That's hard. So how are we going to get there? Looking at the case, how does the court get to that duty? There's a special relationship. Bingo! Because you can't get to that duty unless it's a special relationship. So what special relationship do you have here that caused there to be a duty to warn?
She's under their custody.
It's custodial, right? So you could add it as a new one, prison, or you could just say it's one of those custodial ones, right? So it's a custodial relationship. The state has custody and control over her, therefore this is a special relationship, therefore they pick up this duty to warn. Got it? You can't get to that unless you work through some kind of special relationship. Okay, we're on to breach. So reasonable care to warn and protect is the duty that we're taking into breach. So how do they allege, how did the defendant allegedly breach? What did the defendant do wrong? Yep.
He failed to properly instruct her on how to deal with the snowblower.
But Officer Jenkins said he did.
He said he only spent 10 minutes training her when the maintenance guy spent like significantly longer. He claims that, or the plaintiff claims that he failed to tell her what to do and it should get blocked.
Okay, and he says, I told her what to do. I told her not to put her hand in. So what does the court actually find? Because remember, the court is the jury here. So if you look at what the court actually finds, the court's being the jury. Yep.
The court found that he did not sufficiently warn her. Just saying, don't put your hand in there, you told, was not sufficient. You had to really impress upon her how dangerous this was, because a reasonable person wouldn't be able to figure it out.
Okay, so a little editorializing there. So let's do the trial judge who doesn't editorialize. Okay, so look at the bottom of 427, right? Okay, so the judge finds that they didn't warn her about what? They didn't tell her what? Yep.
That the engine should be shut off completely.
Compared to what she did?
She just turned the PTO switch off.
Right, she turned the link off, but she didn't actually cut the engine off, and they never instructed her on that. What else did they find they didn't tell her?
To never put her hand in the chute.
They never impressed upon her to never put her hand in the chute. Okay, what else didn't they tell her? Which is why you should never put your hand in the chute.
How to unlock the
stuff. So they didn't tell her you must use a stick or water to unblock it. What else didn't they tell her?
There would still be moving parts even after the engine had been shut off.
Right, it's just like a lawnmower, right? To make it run well, there's no friction. So it continues to spin for a long time after you've turned it off. So they do not warn her that it's going to continue to move even though the engine, if you don't know that, stop playing with lawnmowers. Okay. So the cathartics are designed to keep spinning. So they will keep spinning and only slowly stop because they're designed with minimal friction so that they'll work really easily. So they did not warn her that it's going to continue to spinning for a period of time after you turn it off. Okay? So that's the findings of the court. Okay? That they didn't impress on her. Okay? So that's the breach. Right? So the breach is they don't adequately train her so she doesn't know the dangers. Right? Okay. Now we have to do, and the court doesn't really do this, cause in fact. Is their breach the cause in fact of her injury? So what would we have to say to meet that?
We're doing a little review here.
Thought four.
Not training that there would be no certification.
Right, so in the apps, if they had trained properly, because it's a double negative, right? Okay. If they had trained properly, there would have been no injury. She would have not put her hand in and not been injured, okay? How about proximate cause? Who's the foreseeable plaintiff if you do not train? She is. Is it hard? It's easy. What's the foreseeable harm if you don't train someone about the danger of putting their hand in? Bingo. So it's easy proximate cause. Remember, sometimes proximate cause is easy. We read cases where proximate cause is hard, but sometimes proximate cause is you're like, well, duh, of course that's what you were risking. Okay, so we got all the way through there, and we've concluded that the defendant was negligent. We completed the whole case. But to allocate, to run this defense, we also have to see if plaintiff was at fault. Did anyone notice what the court said? It's like a D in my grading book. What did the court say? Because the court knows it now needs to assess whether the plaintiff was at fault. So what does the court say? Mr. King?
She disregarded a potential hazard and failed to use common sense when she inserted her hand into the chute and stud lower.
Well, that's a really in-depth analysis. Thank you very much, court. Right? Everybody see, they do it in one line. The court finds plaintiff disregarded a potential hazard and failed to use common sense when she inserted her hand. Love and kisses, that's duty, breach, causation, injury, all in one sentence. You just work the rest out. Now, they can do that because they're a court. You can't do that, right? That is a D. That is pathetic. Okay, instead, we're going to have to make sure every element is met before we can go ahead and say she lacked reasonable care. Okay, so injury, what's the one thing we have to make sure if we're going to do comparative fault? The injury is the same, right? Because we're going to say that she's responsible for the same injury. So injury is just the same. Anyone recall what the duty is? I don't know, this was a long time ago, so we have forgotten it. What duty does everybody owe? I heard it. Reasonable care for your own safety, right? Every person has an obligation to take reasonable care for their own safety. Excellent. I like what you think. Okay. Breach.
Why do you think she didn't take reasonable care?
What would you point to?
Lack of common sense.
That's a judgment, not the action. So what's the action?
Stick her hand in the snowblower.
She puts her hand in to clear, right? What alternative conduct? So we're going to do a little bit more breach right here. Puts hand in. What alternative conduct would you suggest she should have taken? Yep.
Using water, using a stick, using anything to not put hand in.
Right. Using water, using a stick. Today they all come with little plasticky clear bits.
My own snowblower. Like all that.
Right. So it comes with a little stick to clear it with. I'll use water or use a stick. So we're suggesting that a reasonable person would have used a stick or something to clean it with. Yep.
Or at the very least turn off the snowblower.
Okay, so you could say her problem was that she didn't actually fully turn it off, and reasonable care would require you to turn it off and wait 5 minutes. Yeah. Right, because you have to wait till the blade stops. Okay, so you could say that's the alternative conduct I'm looking for. Yep.
You just said to ask before doing anything more.
So you could say re-ask. Reasonable care would to be re-ask. You could.
You can.
Now, anyone think that those sound a little ridiculous in this situation? Who does she actually have to ask? The guard. Who does she have to ask for a stick or boiling water? Hey, can I have a stick? Or other sharp object? Okay, so it's really interesting. The court is like, oh, reasonable care requires these alternatives, but it's not your average situation, right? Where you can easily get advice or easily get alternatives. Just a suggestion that prison may be not the same as your front yard. Okay. So you have got a breach, according to you guys. I'll come back, because I don't actually think there's a breach. Cause, in fact, but for her negligence, would there be an injury? No, right? If she hadn't put her hand in, there would be no injury, so we can get through cause. In fact, we also need to get through proximate cause. Who will foreseeably be harmed if she puts her hand in? Herself. And what kind of injury do we foresee if she puts her hand in?
Fingers.
Okay.
Injury and cause will always be the same. Or no? For a comparative fault.
No. Well, because you're coming off a different breach. Right? So over here, you're running causation off this breach. That was a very good question, actually. Which is the failure to warn. Over here, you're running proximate cause off putting the hand in. So you could get different answers, okay. Right? Because you're mooring the causation in a different breach. Got it? Everybody see what she asked? It's a different breach over here that you run through causation. It's not the same breach, so you could get a different answer. Good. Are we good? Okay, now assign a percentage. I don't want to make an offer.
Sixty-forty,
60% on the defendant, 40% from the plaintiff. Plaintiff recovers, but it's discounted. Anyone think they should offer a different? We're just comparing the faults. Anyone want to offer something else? Yes.
Do you bring any special relationship when thinking about this? Is this custodial? Wouldn't he have reasonable care to protect her and instruct her better than she would take reasonable care for herself?
So how did she breach?
By not knowing to not put her hand into the snowboard.
And why did she not know?
Because the custodial didn't instruct her not to.
So if they had fulfilled their duty, would she have lacked reasonable care? I think this should be zero. Because what is her breach? Right? Her breach is... And why wouldn't she know to put her hand in? Because? Did they tell her?
No.
They didn't train her or tell her it's dangerous to do it. So an argument you can make is you can't use plaintiff's behavior as a lack of reasonable care if you yourself have caused it. Okay, now you're all skeptical. You're like, everybody knows not to put their hand in. Go look up hockey guy puts hand in snowblower and misses first third of NFL series. Room fast enough to sew them back on. That is the issue.
Well, you've got
snowboard
on.
Huh? What?
Yeah, see, that's what cuts the snow and the ice before they push it through. See, some people don't even know there's blades in there.
Yeah. I thought it was just like a band.
No, there's massive blades that cut it up and then they blow it. Well, that's fine, but they don't tell her.
Yeah, this is U.S. Safety Commission.
U.S. Safety Commission! No, it's a little no. Yes? So he says it's even, so what are you arguing though? He says there's a big sticker that says don't put your hand in. So where is that going?
That she is more at fault.
She's more at fault. Where else could you put it? What are you really arguing? Yeah, that's where you're putting it. Where else does it go? That's what's weird about this case.
It would go on the defendant's breach because they would not be negligent in not telling her if it is that obvious that you shouldn't do it. I shouldn't have to say, don't stab yourself with this knife. It might hurt.
But so if there was really a big label, you would expect them to have raised it right there, right? You would have expected them to say, my guess is there was not a big label. Because you would expect over here for them to argue, we did warn her, and there was a big sticker that said, never do this. But, so it may be that there was a sticker, but it's kind of weird they don't argue over here, because then they would be saying, we didn't breach because there was an adequate warning. So you can use it over here, but what's weird about this case is those two are interrelated. Yes?
Sorry, I found him. It was one of the most famous players, Joe Sackett.
And? Read the whole thing.
Yeah, he missed a few weeks because it says he broke three fingers in a snowboard.
And he says, I was really lucky. I just didn't think. Okay, that's because all of the guys are just like, where's your broke finger? And I'm like, hockey dudes do it, and they skate on the ice every day. Okay. What else should we do? Okay, let's do one more little trick. Yes?
Could the plaintiffs do the prison for negligent entrustment somewhere?
So that would just be, so this is the prison, okay? But on a different theory, negligent entrustment. You could try it, though. Negligent entrustment is usually something, you usually use it for kids. And the thing they give you is so powerful and so dangerous. So it's tough here to say just giving a snowblower to someone is by itself. So see how you just shifted the negligence, that they were negligent in giving her the snowblower. If you do that and you give it to a 10-year-old to run, which I see around my neighborhood with orange avatar on the screen, that I think is negligent entrustment because you just know they can't handle it.
So most of the negligent entrustment cases are giving guns or cars to kids. I'm going to pretend you didn't say that. Okay? So, there's nothing in the record to show that she had a decreased mental capacity. If it did, it would come right in here when you refine the breach. Right? So it would actually lower her care. Okay? So you could try negligent entrustment, but I don't think it's going to run with a snowblower to an adult. Okay. Suppose you assign the percentage this way. What's the result in Ohio?
She gets nothing.
She takes nothing, right? She takes nothing. So we have to distinguish right now, in our limited time left, but we'll do a little bit more tomorrow and then do an exercise, between two types of comparative systems. So once we've elected to do comparative fault, there are actually two versions. What are the two versions of comparative fault that you can adopt? Yep.
Pure.
Pure does what?
It means like no matter what the percentages are, you get that much. If it's 99 to 1, you get 1.
Right. So if you adopt a pure comparative fault system, there is never a bar. It's always just a percentage discounting. Okay? Versus what do we call the type with a bar?
Modified comparative fault.
Modified. So modified are going to have a bar and then a percentage discounting. So if the plaintiff's fault is just a certain level, it's a bar. If the plaintiff's fault is less than that, it's a percentage discounting. So, if you take your beautiful hypo sheet, we'll do the first half of it, and we'll come back and do the second half. Okay, so running down the right-hand column are a series of hypos, and running across are different systems. So let's first start traditional contributory, still remaining in only four or five states in America. Can the plaintiff recover if her fault is 10%? Answer? Takes nothing. 50%. Takes nothing. 60%. Takes nothing, right? So with contributory, as soon as you have an iota of fault attributed to the plaintiff, plaintiff takes nothing in a negligence case. Pure comparative. We're working across. If plaintiff's fault is 10%, what does plaintiff recover?
10%.
No. 90%, right? She's discounted by her 10%. If plaintiff's fault is 50%, what does she take? If plaintiff's fault is 60%, what does she take?
40.
Excellent. Okay. So that's pure. Everybody see pure? There's no bar. There are two types of modified. So see those next two columns? And the difference between them is what to do with the 50-50. Okay? So if you look at the first column, plaintiff is barred if plaintiff's fault is equal to or greater than defendant. So the bar is triggered if plaintiff's fault is equal to or greater than defendant. If plaintiff's fault is less than the defendant, then we're going to discount. So see how we work? We set the bar, and then below that is a discount. So let's try it. If plaintiff's fault is 10%, what does plaintiff take? If plaintiff's fault is 50, what does plaintiff take? Zero, right? Because she's at the bar. If plaintiff's fault is 60, what does she take? Zero, okay? Let's look at the other type of the statute. So it's the other flavored of modified. Plaintiff's fault is barred if plaintiff's recovery is barred if plaintiff's fault is greater than defendant's, but plaintiff recovers a percentage if she's equal to or lesser than. So, if plaintiff's fault is 10%, what does she take? If plaintiff's fault is 50, what does she take? And if plaintiff's fault is 60, what does she take? Zero. Okay. You may think it is an irrelevant detail whether you set the bar at 50 or 51. Why is anybody in the long reading catching why is this crucially important? What do you think jurors often say?
Just change it.
Sometimes they'll change it, they say sorry for the plaintiff, but why is 50 such a key number? What does the jury say if they really have no clue? 50-50. Juries have a tendency to go, oh, it's about 50-50. Right? That's the number that juries tend to pick. If you're in a system with a bar at 50, it means plaintiff takes nothing. Right? Whereas if you're in a system where the bar is at 51, when the jury splits 50-50, the plaintiff actually takes 50. So that's why it's such a fight on 50, because jurors like that as the split, because remember, they're just making it up. That's the one they like to make up.
I know they discussed it in there, but do most U.S. states now allow the judge to instruct them about what that would mean, or do they...
Bingo. So that's the issue. Do you tell the jury where the bar is? Right? Do you tell the jury? Most states tell the jury. So they'll say to the jury, the bar is at 50 or the bar is at 51. Anyone see what's good about that? What's good about telling the jury where the bar is?
That if they are wanting the plaintiff to get money, they can control that.
Right, so they know, they don't think, oh, we'll just say 50, and then the plaintiff gets nothing. So they're educated when they make that allocation as the results of that education. As the results of that allocation. What's the downside which the states who don't tell worry?
They're not actually making a true judgment on the merits, and if they really think it's 50-50, that they won't say that because they don't want the plaintiff to not get it.
Bingo. They're manipulating the percentages. So many people think the jury actually does what? So if you were looking at this case, you might, and you were the jury, what might you do? The thing you're meant to decide last is what? What's the very last thing you meant to decide once you do the math? After percentage, you decide
how much they get.
How much plaintiff gets. But what do you think people suspect jurors do? Work out how much they want them to get, then go back and fix the percentages so the plaintiff gets the amount of money they want. Most people theorize this, so they'll look, oh, she should get her medical card, she should get her expenses. How much is that? Oh, okay, that means she was 32.36% negligent. Got the right amount. So many theorize that the jury don't just fix the percentages, they actually go to the bottom. Once you tell them what's going on, they're not stupid, they're very intelligent, they go back and they decide how much they want you to get, and they fix the percentages. But remember, you picked this system. You thought it was awesome. Okay, we have one last vote to take. Tomorrow we can do